Chapter 27. Peter's Church in Rome, and, in a corner the corner nearest the rack, where the old flintlocks hung a busy merry populous scene, entitled, St. Mark's Square in Venice. This picture, from the first, had singularly taken little Tony's fancy. His unformulated criticism on the others was that they lacked action. True, in the view of St. Peter's, an experienced-looking gentleman in a full-bottomed wig was pointing out the fairly obvious monument to a bashful companion, who had presumably not ventured to raise his eyes to it, while, at the doors of the Seraglio, a group of turbaned infidels observed with less hesitancy the approach of a veiled lady on a camel. But in Venice, so many things were happening at once more, Tony was sure, than had ever happened in Boston in a 12-month or in Salem in a long lifetime. For here, by their garb, were people of every nation on earth, Chinamen, Turks, Spaniards, and many more, mixed with a parti-colored throng of gentry, lackeys, chapmen, hucksters, and tall personages in parson's gowns who stalked through the crowd with an air of mastery, a string of parasites at their heels. And all these people seemed to be diverting themselves hugely, chaffering with the hucksters, watching the antics of trained dogs and monkeys, distributing doles to maimed beggars, or having their pockets picked by slippery-looking fellows in black, the whole with such an air of ease and good humor that one felt the cut purses to be as much a part of the show as the tumbling acrobats and animals. As Tony advanced in years and experience, this childish mumming lost its magic, but not so the early imaginings it had excited. For the old picture had been but the springboard of fancy, the first step of a cloud ladder leading to a land of dreams. With these dreams the name of Venice remained associated, and all that observation or report subsequently brought him concerning the place seemed, on the sober warranty of fact, to confirm its claim, to stand midway between reality and illusion. There was, for instance, a slender Venice glass, gold powdered as with lily pollen or the dust of sunbeams, that, standing in the corner cabinet betwixt two low-stuffed caddies, seemed, among its lifeless neighbors, to palpitate like an impaled butterfly. There was, farther, a gold chain of his mother's, spun of that same sun pollen, so thread-like, impalpable, that it slipped through the fingers like light, yet so strong, that it carried a heavy pendant which seemed held in air, as if by magic. Magic. That was the word which the thought of Venice evoked. It was the kind of place, Tony felt, in which things elsewhere impossible might naturally happen, in which two and two might make five, a paradox elope with a syllogism, and a conclusion give the lie to its own premise. Was there ever a young heart that did not, once and again, long to get away into such a world as that? Tony, at least, had felt the longing from the first hour, when the axioms in his horn book had brought home to him his heavy responsibilities as a Christian and a sinner. And now here was his wish taking shape before him, as the distant haze of gold shaped itself into towers and domes across the morning sea. The Reverend Ozias Mounts, Tony's governor and bear leader, was just putting a hand to the third clause of the fourth part of a sermon on free will and predestination as the Hepzibah B' anchor rattled overboard. Tony, in his haste to be ashore, would have made one plunge with the anchor, but the Reverend Ozias, on being roused from his lucubrations, earnestly protested against leaving his argument in suspense. What was the trifle of an arrival at some papistical foreign city, where the very churches wore turbans like so many Moslem idolaters, to the important fact of Mr. Mounce's summing up his conclusions before the muse of theology took flight? He should be happy, he said, if the tide served, to visit Venice with Mr. Bracknell the next morning. The next morning, ha! Tony murmured a submissive S, sir, winked at the subjugated captain, buckled on his sword, pressed his hat down with a flourish, and before the Reverend Ozias had arrived at his next deduction, was skimming merrily shoreward in the Hepzibah's gig. A moment more, and he was in the thick of it. Here was the very world of the old print, only suffused with sunlight and color, and bubbling with merry noises. What a scene it was! A square enclosed in fantastic painted buildings, and peopled with a throng as fantastic. A bawling, laughing, jostling, sweating mob, parti-colored, parti-speeched, crackling and sputtering under the hot sun like a dish of fritters over a kitchen fire. Tony, agape, shouldered his way through the press, aware at once that, spite of the tumult, the shrillness, the gesticulation, there was no undercurrent of clownishness, no tendency to horseplay, as in such crowds on market day at home, but a kind of facetious suavity which seemed to include everybody in the circumference of one huge joke. In such an air the sense of strangeness soon wore off, and Tony was beginning to feel himself vastly at home, when a lift of the tide bore him against a droll-looking bell-ringing fellow who carried above his head a tall metal tree hung with sherbet glasses. The encounter set the glasses spinning and three or four spun off and clattered to the stones. The sherbet seller called on all the saints, and Tony, clapping a lordly hand to his pocket, tossed him a ducat by mistake for a sequin. The fellow's eyes shot out of their orbits, and just then a personable-looking young man who had observed the transaction stepped up to Tony and said pleasantly, in English, "I perceive, sir, that you are not familiar with our currency. Does he want more?" says Tony, very lordly, whereat the other laughed, and replied, "Colin, you have given him enough to retire from his business and open a gaming house over the arcade." Tony joined in the laugh, and this incident bridging the preliminaries, the two young men were presently hobnobbing over a glass of canary in front of one of the coffee houses about the square. Tony counted himself lucky to have run across an English-speaking companion who was good-natured enough to give him a clue to the labyrinth, and when he had paid for the canary in the coin his friend selected, they set out again to view the town. The Italian gentleman, who called himself Count Rialto, appeared to have a very numerous acquaintance, and was able to point out to Tony all the chief dignitaries of the state, the men of ton and ladies of fashion, as well as a number of other characters of a kind not openly mentioned in taking a census of Salem. Tony, who was not averse from reading when nothing better offered, had perused The Merchant of Venice and Mr. Otway's Fine Tragedy, but though these pieces had given him a notion that the social usages of Venice differed from those at home, he was unprepared for the surprising appearance and manners of the great people his friend named to him. The gravest senators of the Republic went in prodigious striped trousers, short cloaks and feathered hats. One nobleman wore a rough and doctor's gown, another a black velvet tunic slashed with rose color, while the president of the dreaded Council of Ten was a terrible strutting fellow with a rapier-like nose, a buff leather jerkin and a trailing scarlet cloak that the crowd was careful not to step on. It was all vastly diverting, and Tony would gladly have gone on forever, but he had given his word to the captain to be at the landing place at sunset, and here was dusk already creeping over the skies. Tony was a man of honor, and having pressed on the count a handsome damascened dagger selected from one of the goldsmith's shops in a narrow street lined with such wares, he insisted on turning his face toward the Hepzibah's gig. The count yielded reluctantly, but as they came out again on the square they were caught in a great throng pouring toward the doors of the cathedral. "They go to benediction," said the count. "A beautiful sight, with many lights and flowers. It is a pity you cannot take a peep at it." Tony thought so too, and in another minute a legless beggar had pulled back the leathern flap of the cathedral door, and they stood in a haze of gold and perfume that seemed to rise and fall on the mighty undulations of the organ. Here the press was as thick as without. And as Tony flattened himself against a pillar, he heard a pretty voice at his elbow. "H, sir, oh, sir, your sword." He turned at sound of the broken English, and saw a girl who matched the voice trying to disengage her dress from the tip of his scabbard. She wore one of the voluminous black hoods which the Venetian ladies affected, and under its projecting eaves her face spied out at them as sweet as a nesting bird. In the dusk their hands met over the scabbard, and as she freed herself a shred of her lace flounce clung to Tony's enchanted fingers. Looking after her, he saw she was on the arm of a pompous-looking greybeard in a long black gown and scarlet stockings, who, on perceiving the exchange of glances between the young people, drew the lady away with a threatening look. The Count met Tony's eye with a smile. "Oh, one of our Venetian beauties," said he, "the lovely Polixena Cater. She is thought to have the finest eyes in Venice." "She spoke English," stammered Tony. "Oh, ah, precisely. She learned the language at the court of St. James, where her father, the senator, was formerly accredited as ambassador. She played as an infant with the royal princes of England." "And that was her father?" "Assuredly. Young ladies of Donna Polixena's rank do not go abroad save with their parents or a duenna." Just then a soft hand slid into Tony's. His heart gave a foolish bound, and he turned about half expecting to meet again the merry eyes under the hood, but saw instead a slender brown boy, in some kind of fanciful page's dress, who thrust a folded paper between his fingers and vanished in the throng. Tony, in a tingle, glanced surreptitiously at the Count, who appeared absorbed in his prayers. The crowd, at the ringing of a bell, had in fact been overswept by a sudden wave of devotion, and Tony seized the moment to step beneath the lighted shrine with his letter. "I am in dreadful trouble and implore your help, Polixena," he read, but hardly had he seized the sense of the words when a hand fell on his shoulder, and a stern-looking man in a cocked hat, and bearing a kind of rod or mace, pronounced a few words in Venetian. Tony, with a start, thrust the letter in his breast, and tried to jerk himself free, but the harder he jerked the tighter grew the other's grip, and the Count, presently perceiving what had happened, pushed his way through the crowd, and whispered hastily to his companion Colin, "For God's sake, make no struggle. This is serious. Keep quiet and do as I tell you." Tony was no chicken heart. He had something of a name for pugnacity among the lads of his own age at home, and was not the man to stand in Venice what he would have resented in Salem, but the devil of it was that this black fellow seemed to be pointing to the letter in his breast, and this suspicion was confirmed by the Count's agitated whisper. "This is one of the agents of the Ten. For God's sake, no outcry." He exchanged a word or two with the mace bearer and again turned to Tony. "Why, you have been seen concealing a letter about your person, and what of that?" says Tony furiously. "Gently, gently, my master. A letter handed to you by the page of Donna Polixena Cater. A black business. Oh, a very black business. This Cater is one of the most powerful nobles in Venice, I beseech you, not a word, sir." "Let me think deliberate." His hand on Tony's shoulder, he carried on a rapid dialogue with the potentate in the cocked hat. "I am sorry, sir, but our young ladies of rank are as jealously guarded as the Grand Turk's wives, and you must be answerable for this scandal. The best I can do is to have you taken privately to the Palazzo Cater, instead of being brought before the council." "I have pleaded your youth and inexperience." Tony winced at this, "and I think the business may still be arranged." Meanwhile, the agent of the Ten had yielded his place to a sharp-featured, shabby-looking fellow in black, dressed somewhat like a lawyer's clerk, who laid a grimy hand on Tony's arm, and with many apologetic gestures, steered him through the crowd to the doors of the church. The Count held him by the other arm, and in this fashion they emerged on the square, which now lay in darkness save for the many lights twinkling under the arcade, and in the windows of the gaming rooms above it. Tony by this time had regained voice enough to declare that he would go where they pleased, but that he must first say a word to the maid of the Hepzibah, who had now been awaiting him some 2 hours or more at the landing place. The Count repeated this to Tony's custodian, but the latter shook his head, and rattled off a sharp denial. "Impossible, sir," said the Count. I entreat you not to insist. Any resistance will tell against you in the end. Tony fell silent. With a rapid eye he was measuring his chances of escape. In wind and limb he was more than a mate for his captors, and boyhood's ruses were not so far behind him, but he felt himself equal to outwitting a dozen grown men. But he had the sense to see that at a cry the crowd would close in on him. Space was what he wanted. A clear 10 yards, and he would have laughed at Doge and Council. But the throng was thick as glue, and he walked on submissively, keeping his eye alert for an opening. Suddenly the mob swerved aside after some new show. Tony's fist shot out at the black fellow's chest, and before the latter could right himself the young New Englander was showing a clean pair of heels to his escort. On he sped, cleaving the crowd like a flood tide in Gloucester Bay, diving under the first arch that caught his eye, dashing down a lane to an unlit waterway, and plunging across a narrow humpback bridge which landed him in a black pocket between walls. But now his pursuers were at his back, reinforced by the yelping mob. The walls were too high to scale, and for all his courage Tony's breath came short as he paced the masonry cage in which ill luck had landed him. Suddenly a gate opened in one of the walls, and a slip of a servant wench looked out and beckoned him. There was no time to weigh chances. Tony dashed through the gate, his rescuer slammed and bolted it, and the two stood in a narrow paved well between high houses. 2. The servant picked up a lantern, and signed to Tony to follow her. They climbed a squalid stairway of stone, felt their way along a corridor, and entered a tall vaulted room feebly lit by an oil lamp hung from the painted ceiling. Tony discerned traces of former splendor in his surroundings, but he had no time to examine them, for a figure started up at his approach, and in the dim light he recognized the girl who was the cause of all his troubles. She sprang toward him with outstretched hands, but as he advanced her face changed, and she shrank back abashed. "This is a misunderstanding, a dreadful misunderstanding," she cried out in her pretty broken English. Oh, how does it happen that you are here?" "Through no choice of my own, madam, I assure you," retorted Tony, not overpleased by his reception. "But why, how did you make this unfortunate mistake?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.